So let's start with the truth about now the third area, number C, and this is Muhammad himself. The problems with Muhammad. If this is wrong, then everything comes crashing down, just like Mecca. We shut down Mecca this morning. Once you take away Mecca, you could take away from Muhammad or the Quran from Mecca, because there may be a Quran, there may be a Muhammad, but he's not from Mecca. If he's not from Mecca, it's not Islamic. All right, and that's why it's important that we take each one of these three legs and shut each one down subsequently or sequentially. So introduction, what about Muhammad's name? Let's start with the name itself, because this is probably the biggest confusion. This is what the Muslims claim. The Muhammad, and notice I put it in parentheses there, because that's the name they're looking for. The Muhammad of Islam was the last and greatest prophet who lived in Mecca between 570 and 622 and died in Medina in 632. He modeled Islam as the paradigm for the world. He received the Quran as the final revelation for the world. Everything we need to know about him, we can find in the Sirah of Ibn Hisham. Remember, I talked about Ibn Hisham. Is there any Sirah of Ibn Hisham? No. So when does the Sirah of Ibn Hisham, when was it created? Heinrich Ferdinand Wüstenfeld was the first to write the Sirah of Muhammad. And when did he write it? 1868 to 1870. I'm sorry, 1858 to 1860. So that is 160 years ago. There was no Sirah. All attributed to Ibn Ishaq. But as you open up the introduction, it's really to Ibn Hisham. So everything we know about Muhammad, what he did, is attributed by a German scholar living in Berlin, getting his material from four different German cities, putting it together over a two-year period, and then publishing it in 1860. That's 1,000 years too late, folks, because that's just 160 years ago. Prior to 160 years, they didn't have a story about Muhammad. They just knew bits and pieces about him, but no one had written it down. That's why we're all thankful to Heinrich Ferdinand Wüstenfeld. Now, these references are 9th to the 19th century, 200 to 1200 years after the fact. So is this Muhammad of Islam referred to in the 7th century? Because I don't care about Ibn Hisham. I don't care about Ibn Ishaq. I don't care about Wüstenfeld, really, because they're much too late. Why should I go to somebody who's writing 2 to 3 to 1,000 years later about a man who lived in the 7th century? We would never get away with that with Jesus Christ. You cannot go to someone written in the 3rd, 4th, and 5th century about someone living in the 1st century. And that was asked of us, remember, back in the 1800s, when we were asked the same thing. Who is this Jesus? Where did he live? Where did he die? And that was a good question. The Germans needed to ask us this. And so that's why we had to answer those questions. We demand the same thing of Islam. So before finding out, we need to deal first with the name, the word itself, Muhammad. Let's look at that name. What is a name? Is it Muhammad or is it Mahmud? Mim, ha, mim, dal. They go from, actually it should be this other way around. Arabic goes from right to left. I've read it from left to right for your sake. But it actually goes mim, ha, mim dal, this way. That's what we're looking at, folks. Because there were no vowels in the 7th century. There was no Muhammad. It was Mahmud. And that's what's confusing people. People think there must be a Muhammad. There was no Muhammad because there was no vowels to even no one could have even read Muhammad. You could say Muhammad, but we're talking about written sources. Written sources all have four letters. In this case, mim, ha, mim, dal. In the 7th century or earlier, in Arabic, it would have been Muhammad because there were no vowels in Arabic that early. All they had was 16 consonants. Today we have 28. The reason we have 28, because of the 8th and 9th century, they had to start making other vowels. They had to start making other letters. And they had to create five dots to create the five new letters. And they had to create three vowels, the Dhamma, the Kasra, and Fatha, to create the three vowels. The vowels were only created and added in the 8th, and actually were only canonized in the 9th century, another 200 years after the fact. Let me just make my point. Take a look at these manuscripts. Those are four of the six major manuscripts. You have the Mu'tal manuscript on the left that's in the British Library. You have the Samarkand manuscript that's next after it that's in Uzbekistan, in Tashkent. You have the Petropolitanus manuscript, which is there in Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris. And then you have the Sana manuscript, which is on the right, which is in Yemen. Notice not any of them have dots, right? Do you see any dots there above and below the line? Do you see any Dhamma, Kasra, Fatha, any curlicues above them, any slashes above them, any slashes below? Nothing. They're just consonantal text. These are all the earliest manuscripts. And most Muslim Arabists should know this. I'm surprised that even the Arab scholars don't understand this. You can't have Muhammad in any of these texts. Now, this one here starts to show it. This is the Topkapi manuscript, which was probably written in the late, mid to late, possibly even the 9th century. You're starting to see, if you look real carefully, there's some dots there. You notice there is a medallion. Dots are starting to form, but they're even putting them in a red letter, in red dots. So they're added at a later date, possibly even 100 years later, these could have been added. We're not permitted to do any forensic testing on the Topkapi. Otherwise, we'd love to know when that ink was added. I would suggest that because none of the others have it, neither does this have it. Nonetheless, we've got to admit that there are some dots on that manuscript. So what is the name? What exactly does Muhammad mean? Well, I'm just giving you the answer right there. It's on the screen. It means the praised one. It means the blessed one. It means the anointed one. And then it became known as the Messiah itself in Arabic. So the Muhammad was the Messiah. Are you starting to see what's going on here, folks? Thus, it's not a name. It's a title. It's what they do. They're the praised one. That's an adjectival title describing who they are. Every case you see it in the 7th century, it's always a title, not a name. It became a name of a man in the 8th and 9th century, but not in the 7th century. And what have I said all yesterday and today? What have I said over and over again? Don't waste my time with the 9th century. Take me to the 7th century. We need to know what it meant in the 7th century. Because languages do change. Oh, that's a beautiful set of threads you've got on right there. What am I saying? You have no idea. But if you're in America, you know that's a beautiful set of clothes you got on. So even the word threads, or something like simple like gay, if you look at all the 1800s, 1900s, someone who is gay is someone who is happy. But today, if you're gay, that means you're a homosexual. So words do change, meanings do change. The same way with Muhammad. Muhammad has always changed. In fact, if you want to do a historical study on it, it was first used by the Ugaritics in 1400 BC. It's been around for 3,400 years. It's nothing new. But the Hebrews used it as well. It's right through the Old Testament. 11 times you will see Muhammad in Hebrew, the praised one, the altogether lovely, Song of Solomon 5:16. Now, Andrew, or Iqbal, you remember that the Muslims always come to us and they say they finally found Muhammad in the Old Testament, right? And they always find it right there in Song of Solomon. They actually are correct. But they didn't find Muhammad, they found Muhammad. They have no idea what they found. This is exactly what they're supposed to find. In 1000 B.C., Muhammad was Solomon, the son of David, who was the altogether lovely one, the adjectival phrase. But not the Muhammad of Islam. He was referring to himself in that verse. By the time it gets into Christian use by the Syriac writers, St. Jerome, in the 4th century, then applied it in Syriac. Now remember, Syriac, Hebrew, and Arabic all use the same roots. They all use the same consonantal roots. So in Syriac, the Muhammad, according to St. Jerome, was the praised one, the Messiah, who is yet to come a second time. So from the 4th century on, every time you see Muhammad on a Syriac source or in an Arabic source written by Christians, it was always referring to Jesus Christ, the Messiah, to come again. But it wasn't just the Christians who used this word. The Jews used it as well. And if you go up on Fander Films, we've done a whole series on the Jewish exilarchs. They've been up there in the last 2-3 weeks. We put them up there. Look at all the sequence of these exilarchs. These exilarchs are these leaders of the Jews who have been thrown out of Jerusalem, have been thrown out of Judea in 70 AD. They took their leaders with them. They went to what is today Baghdad or Kufa, what is called Hira, and that's where they set up their seminaries. By the 7th century, every one of the leaders of the Jews was known as an exilarch. The exilarchs would always be called the praised one, the Messiah, and they claimed themselves to be the Messiah. And as soon as that exilarch died, the next exilarch was given that title. As soon as he died, the next exilarch was given that title. They were all considered to be the Messiah who is yet to come. 5 exilarchs that we have now recorded in the 7th century all claim to be the Muhammad. The Muhammad. The Muhammad. The Messiah. The only reason they lost it is because they died. The next one claims it. So this is well known. This has been going around in that part. So both the Jews and the Christians were waiting for the Messiah, right? The Christians were waiting for the Messiah who's going to come a second time. The Jews were waiting for the Messiah who is yet to come, and they're still waiting. But they all refer to the Muhammad. So Take a look at that coin there. Notice there is Mu'awiyah. He's holding a cross above his head and he's also holding a cross. He is a good Christian, but what's there? There it is, MHMD. Who do you think the Muhammad there is on that coin? Coined in 663. Obviously, the Muhammad must be the Messiah, right? So who do you think the Messiah is in 663 if he's a Christian? I love it. Okay, but that's why now we have the Muhammad coin. Now makes sense. So, conclusion, the Muhammad was well known in that part of the world and at that time, but it was not pronounced Muhammad. That is how we pronounce it today. And that's where the confusion is. Every Muslim reading that think, oh, that must be Muhammad, the prophet. No, it is the Muhammad of Christianity and the Muhammad of Judaism. Knowing that, let's now look at the coins to see where Muhammad was first introduced. So, the coins are great. Why? Because the coins don't lie. They are made out of metal. They're made out of copper. They're made out of silver. They're made out of gold. The Lydians introduced the coins in 600 BC. Coins were used for more than just commerce. Coins created and maintained the ruler's identity. See, back then, they didn't have TV or radio. They didn't have an internet. They had no newspapers back then. So when you came to power as a caliph, the first thing you did was mint new coins, and so that you could introduce yourself, knowing that everybody would have coins in their hands. And the first thing you do is you put your image on the coins. Notice, Islam doesn't allow images, so that's already a problem. How can a Muslim have an image of himself? Secondly, you would put your name on it, so you could say who you are. And then thirdly, you would always put your religious denomination. And everybody, all the coins that are there, Christian, always had a cross on it. You say, how do I know? Look at every other coin. I don't have all the coins to give me. But every Byzantine coin had crosses on it. That was mean you were a Christian. If you were Zoroastrian, you put a fire altar. If you were a Muslim, you would put a crescent, but there was no Muslims. There's no word called Muslim that early. There's no religion called Islam that early. We don't have any trace of anything Islamic, and that's why we find no crescents. Not that early, not in the 7th century, but look what I'm talking about. I'm talking about Mu'awiyah. That's 661. Muhammad would have been dead 30 years by now. So obviously there's a problem here, but the coins don't lie. That's why I say follow the coins to find out what's going on. So once they minted the coins, they then gave it to the whole world so the world would have the name of their ruler and know who he was, what he looked like, and what denomination he went to. They would also put the date on it. That's why we know the dates. And then they would always put the name of the mint on the backside. So what was on a coin? I just said it. The ruler to introduce his reign widely to those he governed. Yet Islam says that these images are haram, are forbidden. Isn't that interesting? Then what are images doing on a forbidden piece of coinage? The religion to create the religious identity, the date to place where that time period was, often beginning with the rule of that empire, and they would mint them, they were where they were. So they would write the name of the mint, and we know where the mints are. So if the mints are Muslim, if they are from Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, and Ali, the mints should be down in in Medina or Mecca, right? Because that's where they all ruled. The mints are always created where they ruled. And we know, according to the Islamic tradition, written in the 9th, 10th, and 11th century, that all of these guys were ruling in Medina. That's where Muhammad was. That's where he went. That's where the caliphate began, in 624. So Umar was there, Abu Bakr was there, Uthman was there, Ali was there, in Medina. Therefore, the mints should be there. Well, here is the problem. The numismatists are having a difficulty, and that's why back in 2020, when I started getting into this discussion, I started putting it up on YouTube, and I started getting an awful lot of responses from numismatists who are experts in coins. All of those who were doing research on them were getting in contact with me, and they say, but few of them, they had a problem because everything they were doing, when they looked at the coin and they tried to describe them, they tried to put the Islamic narrative onto these coins, and they just made no sense. They couldn't explain them because everything that they were leading about, they had no idea came from the 9th and 10th century. They thought that the traditions were written by the Sahaba. Those are the companions of the Prophet. They thought that Ibn Hisham, al-Bukhari, Sahih Muslim, Ibn al-Tirmidhi were all companions of the Prophet. You know they weren't, right? You know their dates now. Ibn Hisham died in 833. Muhammad died in 632. Al-Bukhari died in 870. Sahih Muslim died in 875. They all died in the 9th and 10th century. Muhammad died in the 7th century, 200 to 300 years earlier. So none of these guys had looked at the dates. And I said, if you're going to be numismatists, then for heaven's sake, be historians as well. Look at the names and put the dates on. That's all you need to do, and the dates are on them. So therefore, they started doing that. And this is the problem they found. I said, rather than trying to impose the Islamic traditions on the coins, just read the coins and throw away the traditions. That's your problem. You're trying to throw the Islamic narrative on these coins. Be a historian, be a good numismatist, and just tell me what they say. You're the experts. You're the ones that are going to do it. So one of them is coming. We're going to meet him for the first time in 2 weeks in London. His name is Odin LaFontaine. He's from Paris. He's been working on these coins for 25 years. He owns many of these coins. Now, this is what they lament. This is what they're saying. When you look at the mints where these coins are minted, none of them are down here. They should be down here in Medina and Mecca, because this is where the caliphate was headquartered. This is where the center of Islam was, according to Islam. This is the place that controlled all the way from Afghanistan in the east to, what's the name of Libya, the capital of Libya? Tripoli in the west, from Turkey in the north, all the way to Yemen in the south. That's a huge swath of land. That's the second largest superpower of its day, second only to the Byzantine Empire. So here they are down here. You'd think the coins are all from these two cities. But when they looked at the mints, look and see what they found. Tartus, Hims, Baalbek, Dimash, Dimadia, Abil, Maysan, Jaras, Yubna, Aban, and Ilia. None of them are down here. When they went to the east side, they noticed that they are on Susak, Dash, Arajan, Bishapur, Tanbuk, Iskatar, Khazarun, Dawarajbir, Adashir Kura, and Khavad Kura. I'm desecrating those names. Notice those are all where the Sassanian were, and the others are where the Byzantines are. But what's fascinating, why are there no mints down south? There's a reason, isn't there? It's one word. Water. There's no water there. In order to have mints, you need to have people. In order to have people, you need to have commerce. In order to have commerce, you need to have food. In order to have food, you need to have water. It's as simple as that. The reason there's no mints there is because no one was there. If no one's there, there's no commerce. If there's no commerce, there's no reason to have coins. And you certainly don't mint where no one is. Am I correct? So you go to the mints where they are. So when you go to the mints, what's interesting, take a look at the mints and notice what we're finding. They're all situated too far to the north. Surprise, surprise. Possibly because the Hijaz was a desert with no water, and where there's no water, you know the rest. So let's now look at the coins. And you need to put them on a timeline. So I'm going to look at the coins from 632 to 661, because that's the time when the caliphate existed. That's the time of Muhammad, from 624 to 632. Then from Abu Bakr, from 632 to 634. And then you have Umar from 634 to 644. And then you have Uthman from 644 to 656. And then you have Ali from 656 to 661. So you have the four rightly guided caliphs and Muhammad. We're talking roughly 40 years, okay? From 624 to 661. That's the 40-year period we need, and we need to find coins, because every one of these were caliphs who minted coins. So what do we thought? Let's go look at the coins. Muhammad dies, but no Islamic coins exist during his time, nor during the entire Rashidun period. Over in the east, the coins are all Christian, or they're Sassanian, and there's a picture of them. So notice, there's a cross, there's a cross, there's a cross, there's a cross. Now, is that a Muslim cross? Okay, help me here. You said that could be anything. What else would it be if it wasn't Christian? See, you're going to have a problem, aren't you, Martin? Okay? No one would put a cross if they weren't a Christian, all right? So let's look at some more coins. Now let's go to Mu'awiyah, because we can't find anything from the time of Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, or Ali. Nothing from the time of 632 to 661 that is Islamic. Nothing that is reference to the Quran. No verses coming from the Quran. No reference to Muhammad. No reference to any of these caliphs. Yet they should be full of reference to these caliphs. But there are Arabic coins. Those I showed you right now, they're all Christian coins. We get to Mu'awiyah, who is the first caliph of the Umayyad Caliphate. He comes to power in 661. He defeats Ali, according to what we're hearing, but we can't find any battle of Siffin in any documents from that time period. It all comes from the Islamic traditions. Nonetheless, the first thing he does, he sets up his shop, he sets up his caliphate in Damascus. Why Damascus? Why not Medina like everybody else? Why has he gone 1,200 miles to the north? You know the answer. There's water there. It's as simple as that. You go to where the water is. You go to where the commerce is. You go to one of the oldest cities in the history of mankind, and that's where you set up your caliphate. So what does he do? He mints coins immediately. Take a look at the coins. I've got them right here. This coin is my coin. I'm now buying them up, because I'm finding if we don't buy them up, the Muslims are buying it up. And once they buy them up, they melt them down. So there's the orb and there's the cross. Here is a whole stave with a cross in it. Above his head, you can see is a cross. On the back side, there's another cross, and there's his name. That's the front and the back of the coin. So there's hundreds of these. In fact, I'm trying to buy them up. Now we get the coin on the right, and that's the most damaging coin. That's the one we looked at earlier. There's Mu'awiyah. That's a cross. And he's got the orb there. There's a mem, which means it's the number 40. And there's a cross above it. And what's this? MHMD. There's the Muhammad. So who do you think that Muhammad is if that's a cross on the other side?
The anointed one.
The praised one, the anointed one, the Messiah. The same word that Messiah means. The Messiah means the anointed one. If you have any doubt, just take a look at his inscription. This is an inscription that Mu'awiyah creates in 663. And it's there on Taif, which is up along the plateau that we saw on the map. If you know, look there. There's his name, Mu'awiyah. But notice it's written in Greek. If you're a Muslim, you'd be writing in Arabic, right? So this is written in Greek, suggesting that he is from the Syriac Brotherhood, and he's probably a Greek writer. And notice what it says at the bottom, that he is Mu'awiyah, there's his name right there, the Abdullah. Abdullah, that's in Arabic now. And in Arabic, he's calling himself the slave of God. Abd means slave of Allah. Why? Because he's an Arabic speaker, because he is from the Nabataean Aramaic background. He is an Ishmaelite, though a Christian. How do I know that? Well, it says here that he is the Mu'minin. Amir al-Mu'minin, servant of God, commander of the believers. What believers? Here we go. Ready? What do you see? Boop, 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 boop. What's up there? Do you see it? How can a Muslim have a cross up there? Now, this is not on a coin, folks. This is on an inscription in Taif in 663. So, obviously, the believers that he is a servant of God, the commander of, are the Christians at that time. He is a good Byzantine Christian, not a Byzantine, a Monophysite Christian at that time, but he is a Trinitarian. All right? So let's put that up there. And now we get to, I'm just going to show you, Martin, look at this here. Notice there's the orb with the cross, orb with the cross. These are Byzantine coins. Now these are gold solidises. These are much more important. There's a coin of Heraclius. There he has an orb and he has a cross. Those are his two sons on either side. And this is a typical Byzantine coin from the 7th century. That's why I'm putting it up there. And if you look at the back side, there's the cross. It's always front, back. That's why there's two images. Now we come to Abd al-Malik. Abd al-Malik comes to power. He's there in Damascus. He is an Umayyad. He comes to power in 685. So this is 60 years after Muhammad, if he lived, supposedly died, right? 60 years later, he introduces this coin here. Take a look at it. You notice it's very similar, don't you? The same. You see the orbs in their hands, right? That's Heraclius with an orb, but what's missing? The very thing that needs to be there. The cross that delineates who they are. There's no cross in any of those orbs. Look at the backside. What's missing? The cross piece. It's a mockery of Byzantine Christianity. This is the coin he introduced. He is living in Damascus. He's right next to the Byzantine Empire. He has to compete against the Byzantines. They are the biggest empire. He is number two. He has to compete politically, and yet he has to give tribute to Justinian II, who is the Byzantine emperor. Justinian II, who receives these gold solidises, goes berserk, gets angered because of what he's done to his coins. See, these are his coins over here, but he puts these coins up. And around the outside is the La ilaha illallah Muhammadur Rasulullah. This is the first time we see the Shahada. The Shahada is now introduced on the backside of this coin. There's only one God but God, and the praised one is the messenger of God, the Muhammad. There's no Muhammad there. It's Muhammad, the same Muhammad we see since the 4th century. Oh, not the 4th century. The same Muhammad that's in Song of Solomon from 1000 BC. The same Muhammad that's there with the Ugarites. It has been around, folks, for over 2,000 years, that Muhammad. And he puts it there because this is the Muhammad that the Christians are waiting for. This is a theological attack, and it's a political polemic. This is a polemic both theologically and politically, confronting Justinian II. They go to war as a result of that coin. Abd al-Malik wins the war. So what does he do next? In 693, he introduces this coin. This is a coin, a victory coin. There he is, the image. Now, hold on a minute. If he's a Muslim, what's he doing with his image there? Again, a real problem here. There's his sword. That is a victory sword. There is La ilaha illallah Muhammadur Rasulullah. There's the backside of the coin. He's mocking him, and he's saying, I am now the victor. I am now the victor. He introduces this in 693, and then in 696, he takes that one away and introduces this one. And this is the coin you have right here. I'm going to pass it around. I bought it finally. This is over $1,500 to buy this coin. This is a gold solidus from Abd al-Malik. This is that coin. You're looking at it right there. There you can see the Shahada. There is what's interesting is look what's written on the coin. First of all, it says, say not three, for God is one and he has no son. Who is that attacking? Say not three. That's attacking the Trinity. For God is one, and he has no son. That's attacking Jesus' divinity, and it's attacking his sonship. For God does not begetteth, nor is he begotten. Who's that attacking? John 3:16. These are all attacks against Byzantine Christianity. These are all attacks against our Lord Jesus Christ, against the Trinity, and against his sonship. Folks, this he's still a Christian, but he is an Arian Christian, just like the Jehovah Witnesses are today. This would be a coin the Jehovah Witness would mint if they were in power. And since he is in power, he controls everything. A man of power, therefore, can impose his anti-Trinitarian beliefs on everybody. But he's still not a Muslim. There's nothing Islamic about this. There's nothing Islamic about Jehovah's Witnesses, right? Because Muhammad's not there. It's the Muhammad who is there, the praised one, the anointed one. So the coins seem to show exactly that what we're seeing along here, these are just Christian coins, but these are anti-Trinitarian Christian. This is a Christian squabble. This is an internecine sectarian debate that's going on. And you can just follow it by following the coins. Let's go to the rock inscriptions. The rock inscriptions say the same thing that the coins say. I've already shown you one inscription by Mu'awiyah. Let's look at some other inscriptions. Note where the rock inscriptions are found. All of the rock inscriptions from the 7th century are found in here, and they're found here. Why are they not found here? No water. Do you see how easy this is? You don't have rock inscription unless you have water. If there's no water there, no people, no food, no people, no towns, no need for rock inscriptions. So it's not till the 8th and 9th century that we start to get these rock inscriptions. So it's in Yemen and it's in Jordan that we find the rock inscriptions, all written in Nabataean Aramaic. Ling Ilka Lindstedt, who has dated the rock, who has done over 40,000 rock inscriptions that he's looked at, and he's really basically wanted to look between the years 640 to 740. So he wanted to look at the time that Islam just began and the Umayyad period was ongoing, because it's the Umayyad period that is the first Islamic caliph. Since we can't find anything about Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, and Ali, let's go with what we can find. So he wanted to see what happened from the time of Mu'awiyah all the way up until when the Abbasids took over. Prior to 690, there were no evidence of anything Islamic on any of the inscriptions at all. Except for formula, everything comes after 690. So in other words, after the end of the 7th century. Muhammad died in 632. So this is 60 years after Muhammad's death, if he lived. Once you, then you start seeing the Prophet Muhammad starting to appear. I should take those vowels out. It's really the Prophet Muhammad appearing in 690 to 710. From 710 to 720, Muslim rites begin to appear. You start seeing reference to pilgrimages, or in prayer, and to fast. And then from 720 to 730, finally, we finally see the word Muslim, and we finally see the word Islam, referring to a specific group of people in contradistinction to Christianity, in competition to Christianity. It was only in the 730s, that's the good, well into the 8th century and onwards, that there is evidence of popular devotion to Muhammad as a prophet and messenger, which makes the Islamic traditions incredibly awkward. Conclusion? There is a 100-year silence prior to this that indicates that Islam did not exist as a distinct religion until long after the time of Muhammad, which casts doubt on whether he had any part in starting Islam. But the name Muhammad does occur in other documents from the 7th century. Actually, I should need to take that out. I need to correct that. It's not Muhammad, it's Muhammad. So just take the vowels out of there, because there's no vowels that early. The name Muhammad does occur in other documents from the 7th century. So now let's look at them. Muhammad in the Quran. Let's see if he's even there. Now, this is done by research is done by one of my researchers named Murad from the Middle East. He's been brilliant because he knows Syriac, he knows Aramaic, he also knows Arabic fluently. And he's done this work for you. I can't tell you any more about him than that. And he says this: there are only four references to Muhammad found in the Quran. Notice Muhammad, M-H-M-D, Mim Ha Mim Dal. That's all you're going to find in the Quran. In the earliest manuscripts. In today's Quran, now they have Muhammad there. Today, yes, they put the vowels in, but not in the 7th century, when the Quran, if it even existed, would have been first written, or as you saw with all those manuscripts. There are no vowels in any of those manuscripts, right? And those are 8th and 9th century Qurans. So even in the 8th and 9th century, this Muhammad is found only four times. Now, hold on a minute. If you look at the Quran, you'll find Moses is referred to 136 times, Jesus is referred to 93 times, Abraham is referred to 79 times, and the Pharaoh is referred to 74 times, suggesting that this Muhammad was not that very popular, or they weren't really concerned with him, because they were more concerned with Jesus than the Messiah as well, right? Now, there's also the Arab word for Masiyah, And that is a title that's uniquely only given to Jesus 11 times. So don't get confused between Mahmud and Messiah. Mahmud is what the Jews and the Christians used. That's why it's in the Quran. But take a look and see what we find. In Surah 3, Ayah 144, it says, and the Blessed One is no more than a messenger. So the Mahmud is the Blessed One. That would be Jesus, because it's in Surah 5, 75, referring to exactly the same word, the Blessed One. In Surah 33, Ayah 40, the Blessed One is not the father of any of your men, but he is the messenger of Allah and the last of the prophets. This verse is used to create prophetic closure. So it looks like whoever this Blessed One, it doesn't have to be Jesus, but it's certainly the last of the prophets. In chapter 47, verse 2, it says, and believe in that which is sent down to the Blessed One, which applies to all prophets. This could be any prophet, including Jesus as well. And chapter 48, verse 29, the Blessed One is the messenger of Allah, which is the second half of the Shahada. Interesting, the Shahada is not found in its complete form anywhere in the Quran. It's in bits and pieces here and there. So the Blessed One is the messenger of Allah. This is possibly the only reference which could be referring to a Muhammad, the man, but most likely it's to Jesus or any other prophet, the Blessed One, the Praised One. None of them refer to a person called Muhammad who lived in the Hijaz in Arabia. They most likely refer instead to the Blessed One. As we have noted, that is what the word Muhammad means, who could very well be Jesus himself. And I would suggest it is. If this is not the prophet from Mecca at all, then Muslims cannot use the Quran to support Muhammad, the prophet's existence in the 7th century, and one of the foundational pillars of Islam begins to fall. Muhammad in the Dome of the Rock. So we go to the Dome of the Rock because that was built by Abd al-Malik, the largest structure of its day. It's still there today in Jerusalem. It's an amazing structure, but be careful, be careful, be careful. It's been destroyed and rebuilt 11 times. It's been destroyed and rebuilt 11 times. The only parts that are the original are where these green arrows are, those two ambulatories. And that's where the inscriptions are. And that's why you need to go to the inscriptions on the ambulatories to understand what is happening in 691 when it was built by Abd al-Malik. Remember who Abd al-Malik is. He is an anti-Trinitarian, right? You saw it on the coins, okay? He loves Jesus, but only as a prophet, like the Jehovah's Witnesses today. They love Jesus, but only as a prophet. He is not God. Jesus is not God. He is not three. And that's why when you look at the inscriptions, the very thing on the coins is on the inscriptions on the Dome of the Rock. Say not three, for God is one, and he has no son. The only thing they do is they put, and the associators believe that he is God. Who are the associators? Those who associate another with God. The mushriks, or the mushrikun in plural. Who are the mushrikun? We are. We are considered to be the associators. Those who believe that Jesus is God, we associate another with God. And remember, the cardinal sin in Islam is shirk. Whenever you equate anything or anybody with God, that's you're committing shirk. So the mushriks are those who commit that. The mushrikun, plural, those of us who do that, are seen as mushrikun. And there it is on the Dome of the Rock. It's attacking us. It's attacking Christians. Not just Christians, Byzantine, Monophysite, Trinitarian Christians. That's what it's attacking. This is all against Jesus, all against his divinity, all against the Trinity. That's why then you have, say not three, for God is one. That then makes its way into the Quran later on in chapter 4, verse 171, but not in the same way you see on the Dome of the Rock, proving that this changes even between the 7th century and the 8th century. For God does not beget, nor is he begotten. That is, again, attacking Jesus' sonship as God. And then it says, La ilaha illallah Muhammadur Rasulullah, there is only one God but God, and the Praised One is the messenger of God. So who is the Muhammad? Since everything else is about who, it's about Jesus. Who is the Muhammad? Jesus is the Muhammad. It's all again, the same subject. The Quranic verses in these scriptures are not the same as that which we have in the Quran today, and are thus possibly the precursors to the Quranic verses, which were then written later and then changed to refer to the prophet. If correct, then Muslims cannot use the Dome of the Rock to support Muhammad's existence in the 7th century either. They cannot even use it as late as 691. And another foundational pillar of Islam begins to fall even further. Well, what about other written references to Muhammad in the 7th century? Let's take a look at them next. So, let's look at extra-Quranic writings. This is outside of the Quran. Let's see what they say. Well, there are actually 15. I could go to 15, but I'm only going to go to 5 because the other The other 10 have nothing to do with Muhammad. They just talk about a warrior or somebody who has a sword or somebody who conquers. And so Muslims will say, ah, see, that must be Muhammad because he had a sword and he conquers. Listen, that could be anybody who's a king who's conquering. Everybody conquered with swords. So you can't say that. But five of them use the word Muhammad. So let's go back to every one of those to use the word Muhammad. Now, you're not going to see it this way. Whenever Muslims write it, they put Muhammad there. No, none of these say Muhammad. That's why we need to be careful, go back to the 7th century, and read the original text. So when you read the original text of Thomas the Presbyter in 634, he talks about a battle between the Romans and the Tayyaye du Muhammad. He does not even use the D, he uses a T. It's not even the same four consonants. This is a Persian spelling of the praised one. Are you hearing that? This is of the Tayyaye. Who are the Tayyaye? The Muhammad of the Tayyaye are the Lakhmids. The Lakhmids live in what is today Tikrit and Mosul. That's in northern Iraq. So this Muhammad lived way up in northern Iraq. Did Muhammad from Arabia live in Iraq? Was he part of the Lakhmids? So here's a reference to Muhammad of the Tayyaye. This is not the Muhammad of Arabia, but there he is in the 7th century. Thomas the Presbyter is referring to him. So already you're seeing that this word is quite common. This title is quite normal. This is a title, in this case, not for Jesus. In this case, it is the praised one, whoever the leader is of the Tayyai there. In 636, a flyleaf refers to the Arabs of Muhammad. So there's the Muhammad, killed many Syrians in Yarmouk. So whoever this Muhammad was, this praised one, which most kings took on for themselves, it could be an exilarch in this case. Because what do we know? He killed many in Yarmouk. Look and see where Yarmouk is on a map. It's in north. It's in Syria, north of Israel. Did Muhammad ever get up to Syria? No. Did he ever even leave Arabia? No, he never did. 660, you have Sabaeus, who's writing about an Ishmaelite called Muhammad. Notice, he calls him an Ishmaelite. Why does he call him a Muslim? All right? And he's called Muhammad. That's the Persian spelling again. This is the praised one. But notice what he says next. That he aligns himself with 12,000 Israelites against the Byzantines. When did Muhammad ever fight the Byzantines? With Israelites, 12,000 of them. Can you tell me where this happened? Muslims can't tell me. You need to read the whole sentence of what this Muhammad did. There's no record of 12,000 Arabs partnering with Jews and invading Byzantium in the 7th century. So this is not even historical. Then you get to John Bonaparte. Now we're starting to get closer. 690, now we're starting to read that this is the same Muhammad that's on the coins. But look at the date. That makes sense. This is when Abdul-Malik is introducing Muhammad, the praised one. This is when also he has it on the coins, he has it on the caliphal protocols, and he has it on the Dome of the Rock. And he says that this Muhammad, the teacher, leader of the Arabs, this is the first real good reference, but still too far north and still nothing to do with a Muslim or Islam. He is somebody who's a good teacher. That's what we're getting. We get that this Muhammad is now becoming a person in the late 7th century. And then we get to John of Damascus, who writes the Heresy of the Ishmaelites, just the title tells you what it's about. This is a heresy of the Nabataeans, of the Ishmaelites, who come in the line of Ishmael to Abraham. And what does he say? This Muhammad. Now, he does say Muhammad, and he puts the vowels. This is the first time we're seeing vowels put in it, because he's writing in Syriac. He's not writing in Arabic at this time. And he talks about this Muhammad, not Muhammad, it's Muhammad. Why doesn't he call it Muhammad? Because Muhammad hadn't yet existed. But this individual has ludicrous doctrines. And then he goes and refers to what the books that this Muhammad is writing. And he talks about the Book of the Cow. That becomes now Surah 2 in the Quran. Then he talks about the Book of Women. That becomes Surah 4 in the Quran. Then he talks about the Book of the Table. That becomes Surah 5 in the Quran. And then he talks about the Book of the Camel. That becomes Surah 0. There is no Book of the Camel. So obviously, whoever this Muhammad was had four books, not one book, three of them that make their way into the Quran, and the last one got rejected. So is that the Quran, folks? But look at the date, 730. This is 100 years after Muhammad, and still the Quran's not together. And remember who John of Damascus is. He is there living in the courts of the caliph in Damascus. His father was also in the courts of Damascus. His father were in the courts of Muawiyah. He was in the court of Abdul-Malik. He's right there where Islam should be, right at the center of Islam. And yet he calls these Ishmaelites, these heretics. These are the heresies of the Ishmaelites. And then he starts in 730, goes to a monastery and writes about this Muhammad, this ludicrous doctrines. So obviously this is not the Muhammad of Arabia. Every reference to Muhammad in the 7th century places him in Gaza or Jerusalem or Damascus or in Hira, which are all situated too far north and probably refer to other Muhammads, the praised one or the anointed one. Conclusions concerning the coins and the rocks and the inscription. There are no coins anywhere in Central Arabia, and the Arabic coins which do exist are all further north and are not Islamic at all, but Christian or Zoroastrian up to and including the reign of Muawiyah, up to 680. It is only with the coins introduced by Abd al-Malik in 691 that we begin to possibly find pre-Islamic. Now I say, you notice I'm saying pre-Islamic, not Islamic, pre-Islamic coins, but now you can understand why Islam is so anti-Trinitarian. It was because of Abd al-Malik. That's why Islam is against Jesus as God, and that's why that's the first question we get whenever we get into a discussion. It's all because of Abd al-Malik. And whereas that existed in the 4th century with Arius, he was not a caliph, he was not a king, he was not one very important. And he was taken down very quickly at the Council of Nicaea by Athanasius. Now you have someone who now rules probably the most land in the world at that time. Someone of that stature, of that nature, coming up with this theology, no wonder it stuck. And that's why Islam that was finally became Islam during the Abbasid period, that's why they're against Jesus as God. That's why they're against the Trinity. And that's why they're against his sonship. The rock inscriptions are similar to the coins and nothing Islamic prior to 690 AD. Then references to Muhammad from 690 to 710, we start seeing Muslim rites, the pilgrimage, prayer, fast from 710 to 720, and finally the names Muslim and Islam referencing groups which isn't Christian from 720 to 730. The Quran and the Dome of the Rock do not refer to Muhammad of Islam. 7th century written references to Muhammad place him too far north. More than that, as a conclusion, these all suggest that there was an internecine clash between different sects of Christianity. The Trinitarians on one side, who were the Byzantine Monophysites, and the anti-Trinitarians on the other side, who would be Abd al-Malik and his descendants, with the latter establishing its own religion at the end of the Umayyad dynasty in opposition to Christianity, mid-8th century, which then morphed into what Islam of today during the initial 100 to 200 years of the Abbasid dynasty in the 9th and 10th century. Can you now see that's how man-made religion runs? This did not happen in 22 years, folks. We're already 100 to 200 years later. It took 100 to 200 years to get to this point. But still, Islam is not the Islam we have today. That's going to take another 100, another to two, possibly even 300 years before we get the Islam of today.